Welcome to Headson's Living Histories podcast, capturing and sharing the life stories of people who have used or worked in NHS mental health services in Sussex, following the closure of the old asylums in the 1980s, up to and including the COVID-19 pandemic and its aftermath. By listening to people tell us, in their own words, about their experiences, we explore the complex interplay between mental health and a life well lived. Over the course of a year, Living Histories volunteers have recorded 35 in-depth oral history interviews across Sussex, opening up new ways to reflect on the past, present and future impact of mental health on people's lives. The full interviews will remain sealed for 80 years in the Mass Observation Archive at the Keep, housed in the University of Sussex. But in these podcasts, with the permission of the interviewees, we present some of their memories, experiences and reflections for the first time. You might find some of the stories you hear challenging, as participants talk openly about the difficulties of living with mental ill health. Please be aware that topics including mental health crisis, suicide, abuse and neglect are covered in these episodes. Living Histories celebrates the strength, courage and resilience of people living with mental health problems and those caring for them. Our huge thanks to everyone who told their story. This episode, Support and Friendship, explores the vital role of relationships in shaping how people live with and manage mental distress across Sussex. It documents the importance of support from family members, friends, peers, and NHS professionals as we highlight what it means to be vulnerable and how the acts of love, friendship, honesty, and communication can get people through some of their most difficult times. We hear from staff about the great privilege of accompanying someone on their journey and highlight the role we can all play in supporting the people around us who are struggling.
I have an amazing supportive network of family. If I were on my own living this, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be here. I am very aware that as bad as I am one of the lucky ones in terms of having a support, having access to people who can help me with healthy meals and having a garden, you know. It's not just self-discipline.
I mean, we've always been a family that don't talk about our feelings or emotions, which is weird why I became a mental health nurse, because it still happens within our family. We're like, no, don't upset anybody, don't say anything, don't talk about anything. We were in a family that was sort yourself out, pick yourself up, get better. And actually, God, thinking about it, I think I was probably a bit depressed when I was younger. I'd literally get up out of bed and then I would go and lay on the sofa. And my mum got really worried about me. I think she called the doctor out and I think the doctor came to see me. I'm getting a bit confused because there were a couple of times. And I think he said something like, all my energy's just going into growing. So there was no kind of mention of what's gone on. Is she okay? Is her mood all right? Those kind of things sorted themselves out.
My dad, although he never accepted it, was suggested he likely had bipolar type 1. He had periods of like deep depression and it seemed to manifest in anger and irritability, and it was thought that his alcohol use was sort of almost self-medicating. He also seemed to have, well, quite unusual ideas, which was quite confusing as a child. Like, he would tell us stories that he had met God and Jesus and had a cup of tea with them, well, a cup of coffee actually it was, downstairs, and that he'd been brought home from the pub by 7 donkeys. And it was very challenging that you sort of didn't know where you were, that it would be sort of episodes where it was like the sun was out but there was just clouds hanging over everything. And then within a couple of months he could be singing down the street or blowing an air horn to get us all up.
My mother had a cousin who I think had OCD, because they say it can be hereditary. Now, this is a funny question, I mean, he was a strange man. He was very, very fussy and everything, and he lived in West Hampstead, where I lived, And if I was going away, and I used to go abroad a lot then, and he'd look after my flat, and he'd check me over and over again. Now, what time are you coming back? And I have to write it all down. So I'm wondering if it is. They say it can be hereditary in the family. I don't know. My parents weren't, you know, but...
My aunt had mental health needs, bipolar, and I can recall as a child them coming to visit. Particularly one aunt would come to visit when she was in a manic phase. My aunt would arrive, and as soon as she'd arrive, my mum would know that she was manic, and I used to find it absolutely fascinating. And then when she was depressed, the extremeness of her condition, to spending literally days upon days upon end in bed and trying to get her out of bed, your family members trying to get her out of bed. And I used to think this is just fascinating. So I can recall visiting her in a mental health hospital as a young child with my mum and thinking, this place is just beyond what I ever experienced, and sitting outside waiting for my mum to come out. And I thought, I wanted to get in there. I wanted to see what was going on. I always wanted, from as long as I could remember, to be a nurse, and I wanted to be a nurse that cared for people that had mental health needs.
If somebody was sad, or if somebody found something upsetting, or if somebody was going through something difficult, there were always people to love that person and, you know, care for those. We were always very caring, but we probably didn't look at it in a kind of, oh, this person's having trouble with their mental health, we need to step in. We were just, it was like they're having a difficult time, so we need to, you know, close round and give them lots of care and lots of love, and that's what will get them through. And I think it's still like that in my family. You know, as soon as somebody's going through a hard time, we all love each other and care for each other. And of course, I'm the mental health nurse, so they might ask me questions, but they still probably wouldn't ever take any of my advice. I get comments like, oh, stop it, you're not at work now. And yeah, you're always trying to fix things. I don't want you to fix anything or give me advice. I just want you to listen. You know, I just want you to be my sister.
My mother's thing was, oh, if you got raped, it was your own fault, you shouldn't wear a short skirt. And all of this whole generational thing of, so if I'm going to put that in a nutshell, it's to not blame someone for being ill, for needing help. I mean, maybe we can't cope with people. I've tried to help someone recently, which is really, really misfired and not good for my well-being at all, and I'm putting the boundaries down as much as I can.
One of the things that we have learnt as a family is that two opposite truths can be both true at the same time. And my grandmother was a wonderful woman and a wonderful grandmother, and she was an alcoholic, and she was a bully to my mum, and she was a wonderful mother to my dad. And all those are true, but often it's you don't see things like that when you're little. And my childlike mind blamed myself for coming to life, for making my parents be together, and my dad seemed to not be around. They talk about generational trauma. I got lumped with all of it. So I've had three major depressions, each 20 years apart in my life, and I'm working very hard now to make sure I don't get another one in my 80s. My mother's aunt was, we now realise with hindsight, bipolar, but in those days it would never be diagnosed. She was called the mad aunt. But apart from that, I'm it.
Although my father was absent, he was never ever abusive. He's very kind, very intelligent. He retrained in psychoanalysis, I think, in a large part in order to help me and cope with his own guilt, which we have talked about. I used to think that I could not outlive my father, but through lots of therapy, I now know that I can. He has absolutely done his best. And as I've got older, he's been remarkable in his support. Of course, he really struggled when I went to prison. And obviously, my going to prison was not something that he could talk about. He didn't come and see me, which is absolutely fine. I didn't want him to. but he always wrote to me all the time. And also then when I started looking through my own therapy about how I ended up in prison, how I ended up offending, I might be using slightly clinical words for this, but that's because it's easier for me to talk about that way, because I'm deeply ashamed of it. But I was able then to talk to him about all that as I started to come to terms with it. So that's really, really, he's massively supportive. And he also now, I think, because of who I am now and the level of healing and recovering that I have done, he finally talks to me like as if I'm an adult. We've got there now. And I don't blame him for not having done in the past. He's massively influential and important.
I think no family is a completely, you know, but we have more than most to unpack. Or actually, we've done quite a lot of unpacking already, haven't we, as a family. I've pushed it partly because of my mental health and partly because of just how I am about trying to bring people together. And one of the things I've learnt in life is that you can only bring people together through honesty and communication, not through hiding and denying things and repressing things. Unfortunately, I'm much better at helping other people to do that than I am at doing it myself.
I saw setups, you know, that weren't dissimilar to my own, or characters that maybe felt a bit like myself, or, you know, I also saw things that were working really well in family networks, but, you know, not the conventional sort of family networks. Created families, destroyed families, blended families, you know, solitary people, and just people that come out of care. I think what astounded me, people that have been in care all of their grand life and then were just landed in a flat in Mile Oak. I went to see somebody once who had nothing, literally nothing. They had a chair, an upright dining room chair, and a cat. They didn't have any heating, no cooker, no running water, didn't have anything, but they didn't either know that they were entitled to it. So you'd walk into, you know, if you have the privilege of going to someone's space, you can kind of get a bit more of a snapshot of what's missing. It's quite shocking.
When I was at school, I volunteered with Age Concern, which was something I was forced to do for being naughty. But again, it was, I really loved being around older people. I loved their stories. And I really hated sort of seeing people being patronised. Like, oh, come on, dear. Come on, love. And I'm like, they've got a name. I don't know where it came from, but there's something definitely in me that, yeah, it just made me want to help other people. And I do think an element of that is feeling that, growing up, feeling that I was bad or evil or something, because of the things I was called, the names I was called, very much were internalised and stayed with me. Half of me was like, well, if you're calling me that, I'm going to be that. And the other half was like, I need to move away from that and be different.
When we started out, you sent a letter from professional to professional and basically cut out the person you're actually talking about. Now, as the default position is that they will have a copy of that letter. So I think consciously and unconsciously, you are taking account of that. How you write about the patient who's going to read your letter. My earlier days, you can get correspondence. Oh, I saw this chappy this morning and he seems like, you know, you didn't write anything like that these days. You know, this chappy who turned up at my clinic, you know, because that letter, that chappy would be the one who's reading that chappy letter. So you just don't do it anymore. So I think correspondence has, you know, has changed. And I think that's right. I think, you know, if we're not prepared to show what we're writing about people, then maybe we shouldn't be seeing them. Sometimes it gets contentious, so people who either don't agree with what we've or are so unwell. So, for example, sometimes how do you tell somebody who is deluded when, by definition, that person does not know that they're deluded? So I have to find a way of trying to negotiate my way through that, being able to state what the patient's beliefs are, what maybe the evidence we've looked at has so far shown, and maybe not use too technical terms. So I wouldn't refer it to a delusion. I would refer to it as a fixed belief, which is very difficult to move on. Any professional will know that means a delusion. But the idea is to try not to con someone. The idea is to try and keep that therapeutic relationship going so you can actually see them again and hopefully give them another opportunity at moving things forward.
I guess an observation that to me seems to point to something that I think is bizarre is how distracted people are with technology in meetings. For me, if we're together, I like people to be present, you know, and we're holding a space that I see as being, I would say it's sacred. Being in a relationship is a sacred experience, and attention is a hugely powerful asset that we have. You know, someone said attention is the greatest act of love. And, you know, if we give attention to one another, we bring out the best. So I exist in that scene that I don't quite believe in those sort of meetings, but just try to make the best of them as they are.
If I think about the good experiences, I'll always tell you there was a wonderful team. So if I talk about the community job that I had, which was over 20 years, why was that so good? Because there were people doing really good, meaningful work, committed to the cause, but also really supported each other at a time when you could do that. I think you weren't left alone. You obviously monitored and managed, but you were trusted a lot more to do the business that you're trained to do. But also I've never seen such support, you know, so if you're faltering, somebody else will step in. It's not even a big conversation. And for me, that's the essence of what makes it work well. You know, if someone's failing, someone else stands up. If you're taking a difficult phone call and you put the phone down, there's a colleague there with a cup of tea and you never even ask for it. And that's enough to get you through to the next thing. You have to have a culture where you're okay to say, and I won't ever stop doing this, you have to be able to say, I don't know. I don't know the answer. I don't know how to do that. And I think if you work in a culture where that becomes forbidden, you've lost the plot. You have to be able to be a new person in and feel out of your depth and not feel frightened to say, can you help me? I don't know how to deal with that. Can you help me write this letter? Can you sit with me when I see this client? So those things don't just happen. They'll happen when the culture's right.
I got involved with the London Disability Arts Forum, writing about culture that was also about disability rights and about the lived experience, art informed by the lived experience of disability, of chronic health conditions, of mental health issues, all those things. It was just so important to me. It was at the kind of, I'd found my tribe, as it were. I'd found a world that where I felt more fully fulfilled. It felt like, you know, such an important, powerful way of understanding the world through the conversations and through kind of learning about the experiences of people with impairment issues right across the spectrum.
I got to speak to someone that was like a professional about my mental health. So it was about also starting to see that there's two different roles that you can have in your life. There's people you talk to that are your friends, your family, whatever, to whom you explain things, you process things, you live things. But there's also another whole set of people that you can talk to, are professionals, and who have a completely different relationship to you and that can help you in such a way that is very different. But there's a lot of perks to that, and to that kind of having someone that you don't have any tie with except for their employee to help you.
My favourite band is New Model Army. One of their songs is Born Feral, passed from hand to hand like a loaded gun. You know, that's how I felt I was. But they also do an amazing song called Searching for Family, Looking for Tribe. That's why I ended up in squats in North London, not because, well, yes, partly because I'm a raging socialist. I mean, I loved those people. I loved that environment. I love co-living. That's probably why I love mental hospitals and why I love boarding school. I can make a family immediately. It's what I love to do. It's how I feel safe.
Peer support, you may or may not be familiar with, because it's not an age-old thing. I think it came out in the 80s, but it's helping people, for instance, who've in hospital and they want to get back into the community, and it sort of bridges that gap. So you don't wear a uniform, because in mental health it's like a hierarchy, and you know, you feel already down there, and then you can share experiences, so they're going to more likely open up. If you've got a psychiatrist sort of saying this is how it is, or you know, counsellor or that sort of thing, it's not quite the same, but if you, they know you've got lived experience, they're going to be more likely to open up. And so you identify achievable objectives they want to do, and the obstacles that may be in the way, and how they would use their strengths to overcome them, and ultimately to empower them to sort of do that, and also signpost them to different things that may help them do that. So really helping them.
The relationship that I've had with professionals has grown significantly, and there was a lot about trust, like building trust in different people, different professions, in myself, like having them help me develop trust in myself, which was something that I didn't really have at the time.
I think starting to work with Saundra was the start of me getting better, not the medical treatment I was getting, because then I started to engage with other people and help them. That was more therapeutic to me than any other medication. We were doing peer work years before it was called peer work. We were learning from each other, supporting each other. People were looking after me. People were coming and giving me a lift to come to things I had to do. I was going to Norton Cafe and meeting people, and I was forgetting about my own worries and engaging with them, trying to make them feel better.
For quite a long time, I used to think it didn't feel like a job. In fact, a number of my colleagues, my other student colleagues, used to say, it doesn't feel like a job. Because what it feels like is we're living a life with people who have had a difficult life, and we're just helping people. And it feels like what you should be doing anyway. So in that sense, it didn't feel like a difficult sort of life.
I've learned a lot from the people that I've worked with. That includes my colleagues. And I've learned a lot from what I wouldn't want to do. But I've also learnt from really good role models. And that includes, you know, people that I was working with on their journey. Mental health has no concept of who we are in society, does it? It can affect any individual. And we should never, ever forget that. We're all susceptible to having a mental health need. We're all vulnerable at times. And our vulnerability sometimes can take us places that you don't want to go, but without having the support and friendship of somebody, and whether that is through relational security or professional, that can be supportive, can't it?
I think there's a long way to go for a professional who hasn't been diagnosed, say, to really understand what it's like. To really, I think there's a really big gap in experience with professionals towards abuse and towards, because I think it should be, but for the grace of God, there go I. You know, we really are all in the same boat.
Some people have never faced anything. You know, they're so greenhorned. They're not in workplaces, so they're not experienced the peculiar characteristics of any given individual and how you have to manage that and circumvent that, people and relationships, etc., and just the normal world. And so then people come into these environments and they are just shell-shocked because what they hear, what they see, and obviously what certain people have been through with their lives, it's very sad and very upsetting. And for people that have come in greenhorn and not had any life's experiences, which seems to be a lot lately, oh, it's a big challenge.
I would go and sing. And when you're singing, you can't be thinking too much. It's a good discharge without talking about the content over and over and over. Colleagues are great. If you work with the right team, a good team, there's always somebody who's there to debrief or hear, listen, have your back, know what things might impact on you. So I think that means a lot.
But I am a human, and there were times when, you know, God, you lose somebody, when someone dies that you've had a good relationship with, and you can't figure out, or you're left with, what else could I have done? You know, what could I have done? And they're too young, you know, too young to die. And, you know, now the modern day and age, they'll set up a debrief if something like that happened, you know, group sort of debrief to think about, you know, what happened and give you a bit of space for a voice. But largely I'd say it's colleagues. Those colleagues that you're really attuned with, that you're really tuned in with, and, you know, that you can lay it bare and not feel judged or shamed for that, that something impacted. But you could also sort of say, God, that reminded me of my family, you know, and without feeling that there's any judgment with that.
I met some lovely people, some people that weren't that healthy to get to know either. I left that hospital with a boyfriend who was distinctly damaging, bless him, but he was suffering from paranoid schizophrenia. I realised it was not a happy relationship. I was sort of trying to look after him and doing the best I could, but it was damaging my mental health a lot. Nobody called it peer support back then. That was an unknown thing. And often it was actively discouraged. After I came home and that destructive relationship happened, and I was put on the waiting list for a bit of respite on Summersdale. And by the time I got there, they were a bit like, oh, you're worse than we thought. This might be a slightly longer stay than you were anticipating. And actually, I met my husband there. And he was head over heels in love with me fairly quickly, and I was a bit sort of humouring him at first. He proposed to me within 3 weeks, and they were warning him off me because I was too vulnerable. But we've been married for 30 years now, so probably the best thing I ever got out of a hospital admission.
We celebrated our silver wedding anniversary. I would say that, ironically, this depression has brought us closer together. So he struggled very much with my second depression, the first one that he'd experienced. There is no question that he loves me unconditionally, and he's been amazingly supportive through this depression. I think we're probably closer than we have been. And now I guess I'm at the hard bit where you start to be more aware, and in some ways the feelings are harder then, because when you're catatonic, as awful as it was, and I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy, you're in the bottom of that big black hole. There's not really much further down you can go. When you start coming up and feeling the feelings, it's much harder.
I believe in maybe Reading or something, they have or used to have a dating agency for people with mental health issues. I always thought we should do that at Sitton's Advice. I think we'd make a fortune, because, you know, huge number of the people who came in were really lonely and isolated, and about half of them were men and half of them were women. There we are. It never happened. Oh, actually, it did happen. Two of my regulars I'd met, and suddenly one day they came in together. I bet they met in the waiting room. So it can work.
I met a man who I fell in love with. Such a cliche. I literally did not know that that's what being in love with somebody felt like. I didn't understand this whole business of being in love with someone or having a healthy relationship means that you become the best version of yourself and you want the best for them no matter what. As long as it doesn't destroy you in the meantime, in the making of it, you absolutely want the best for them, even if that's something that you have to give up. I've never understood any of that. And we've been together 10 years this year. You know, it's bumpy, but it's quite unlike any other relationship I've had, and I didn't think I would ever have that kind of mutually respectful, trusting I mean, now I don't want to die. Now I get really worried I might die. Like, all those years I wanted to die and I didn't give a shit. I don't want to die now. I really get it. And I love him coming. I get excited when he comes home every night. Just, and he's a grumpy old sod, and I love that about him. And I never thought that was possible. And to think I could have missed out on that. At 45, I think I still wanted to die quite a lot of the time, and I'm so glad I didn't.
This episode of Heads On's Living Histories podcast was produced as part of a collaboration between Heads On and Sussex Partnership NHS Foundation Trust. Living Histories was funded by the National Lottery Heritage Fund, NHS Charities Together and Heads On. We're deeply grateful to all the participants who shared their stories and to the many staff, volunteers and project partners who have made Living Histories possible. If you found this episode interesting and would like to hear more, please visit www.headsoncharity.org/histories, where you can learn more about Living Histories and listen to other episodes. If you've been affected by anything you've heard in this episode, support is available. Please visit www.sussexpartnership.nhs.uk/your-mental-health/getting-help. Audio production by Charlotte Petz and Michael Umney. Music by Chad Crouch. Narration by Living Histories volunteer Ian Barnett. Oral history clips taken from full interviews with project participants from across Sussex for Heads On's Living Histories. For more information about Heads On's other projects, please visit www.headsoncharity.org.